From 89.7 WUWM Milwaukee Public Radio, this is Lake Effect. I'm Mitch Hike.
And I'm Bonnie North. Today on the show, we talk with news analyst Charlie Sykes about the end to DACA, a rocky road ahead for President Trump, and the end of the Sheriff Clark era.
Then a leading concussion doctor says his young patients today take him seriously.
I used to have to scare people, you know, say, this is a concussion, you've got to take it seriously. If you don't, you can have months of symptoms. And I have now moved to the point where I don't even bring that stuff up.
Memorizing music is a crucial skill for classical musicians, but it doesn't always come easily.
There are people who suffer terribly because the process of memorizing is difficult, and when they get on the platform, that's one of their biggest anxieties, that they're actually going to forget what they have to play.
And we'll hear about the second season for the Journal Sentinel's Unsolved podcast. Lake Effect is next. News is first. This is Lake Effect from 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee Public Radio. Thanks for joining us today. I'm Mitch Tyke.
And I'm Bonnie North. The legal status of around 800,000 people is in question after Attorney General Jeff Sessions announced yesterday that the Trump administration will be ending the Deferred Action for Childhood Arrivals, or DACA, program. The president himself had indicated that would happen over the weekend.
The administration's decision throws the ball back in the court of Congress, which will have 6 months before DACA is due to end entirely. Political analyst Charlie Sykes joins us in the studio to look at yesterday's announcement and much more from just the last few days. Welcome back to the show.
It is my pleasure.
Let's start with the news from Tuesday morning. As was hinted at over the weekend, the Trump administration announced it'll be ending the Deferred Action for Childhood Arrivals program, DACA. This is a president who was already not especially popular with pro-immigrant groups. So did this announcement come as any surprise to you?
No, and I don't think anybody who is paying attention to the campaign really should have been surprised by it. There was a lot of speculation that he was agonizing about this. He had suggested earlier that he loves the Dreamers, that they could rest easy. But this is a president who continues to play to his base. Now, I suppose if you're looking for the silver lining, it is the slow rollout of the rescinding of DACA. 6 months kind of kicking the can over to Congress to be able to act on this.
6 months, but for people who are in the country legally under DACA, that probably does not come with a lot of comforts.
No, for a couple of different reasons. I mean, number one, just to go back to how we got here in the first place, of course, Republicans and the administration are pointing to President Obama's overreach in enacting DACA through executive order. But he did that because Congress had failed to act on this. It had passed the House of Representatives, only got 55 votes of the needed 60 votes in the Senate to pass. So Congress, when it had an opportunity, when it was controlled by the Democrats to do this, failed to do it. So the question is, how willing are they to do this now?
Right. So the president sent the responsibility for the 800,000 people in the country on DACA status and any future people who might want to be here back to Congress to figure out. How tricky will this be for the Republican-led Congress?
It's going to be very tricky. First of all, they have so many other things on the agenda to have to do in a very short period of time. Number two, this is an issue that is incredibly fraught for the base. One of the things that Trump has not really explained yet is, would he sign any piece of legislation that they passed, assuming that they could muster the votes to pass it? Is there a possibility that if the base became aroused enough that he might actually veto it? So you have a lot of Republicans who are going to be approaching this very tentatively. Now, you know, Paul Ryan has staked out a position that he wants to see congressional action. He does not want to. He does not want to start deporting the Dreamers. And by the way, just the politics of this issue, the optics would be so horrible of taking 800,000 really law-abiding young people who have jobs, who are studying, some of whom were in the military, and, you know, stripping them of their legal status. This is one of those things that no one, I think, really wants to have happen, or certainly no elected Republican wants to have happen. The question is whether or not they're going to risk having Donald Trump cut them off at the knees.
House Speaker Paul Ryan, as you say, says he favors fixing DACA. What are the fixes that the Republicans could look at?
Well, they could just pass it into law. This is one thing. I mean, you know, legitimately, this is something that Congress should do. It should be in law. It should not be something subject to, the whims of an election or an executive order. But on the other hand, as mentioned before, you know, they've had a chance to do it. They haven't done it before. This should be the easiest of all the immigration issues. There are a lot of complex, tricky, thorny immigration issues. But when you're talking about kids who were brought here, who themselves broke no law whatsoever, who are productive members of society, this should be the easiest bipartisan fix. And the fact that it won't be is an indication of just how toxic our politics have become.
Speaking of toxic, what do you make of the announcement being made by Jeff Sessions rather than the president himself?
Well, you know, Harry Truman used to have a sign on his desk, "The buck stops here." With President Trump, the buck never seems to stop with him. There's always somebody else who has to do the heavy lifting, always somebody else to blame if it goes wrong. I thought two things were interesting. Number one, that you have Jeff Sessions rather than the president announce this. Number two, that Jeff Sessions did not take any questions. Here you have a major policy decision by the administration, affects hundreds of thousands of people, and he would not even answer questions about it. Not a profile of courage.
So as we look forward into September, it seems like there are plenty of other rocky roads to go down for this president and this administration. On top of immigration, there's the tax code reform the president says he wants. There's the debt ceiling debate. There's funding the government. What sort of shape is Donald Trump's vaunted deal-making ability in when it comes to Congress?
Well, there was a very interesting piece in the New York Times that talked about the vaunted deal-making ability, which, by the way, we have not seen yet. We keep hearing it talked about, but we're not really seeing that this is a particularly effective negotiator, in part because, number one, Donald Trump has very little interest or knowledge of the policies that he's talking about. That became very apparent during the debate over health care. So we're going to have to see. There's a huge amount on the table. I think it is unlikely that Congress will not find some way to raise the debt. That would be, unthinkable. They won't shut down the federal government. They probably will come up with a way to fund the disaster relief for Hurricane Harvey. Beyond that, though, everything's a question mark.
Hurricane Harvey, and then we're likely to start hearing a lot more about Hurricane Irma. The president was criticized for the way he spoke on his trip to Texas after Hurricane Harvey. But has anything been off about the way the administration has reacted in the face of its first natural disaster?
So far, not really. Not in terms of substance. Of course, the president's first visit there, made it look like it was a reality TV show. I think he did better over the weekend. But so far, there hasn't been a disaster. On the other hand, keep in mind how expensive this is going to be, how complex this is going to be. We're still in early days. And if this, in fact, was a once in a 1,000-year storm, this is a once in a 1,000-year recovery effort, if that means anything. So we have a long way to go.
So from natural catastrophes to possibly human-caused catastrophes and the state of things between the U.S. and North Korea and President Trump's reaction to it.
Extremely scary. How did we maneuver ourselves into a position where the future of sentient life on the planet is in the hands of Kim Il-yoon and Donald Trump? Remember there was a while there where President Trump was suggesting that his tough rhetoric had gotten the North Koreans to back off, that they were so respectful of his leadership and his rhetoric that they were dialing down their operation. That clearly is not true.
Well, and while we don't see North Korean leader Kim Jong-un on Twitter, his approach to letting the world know his opinion does not seem really all that different than President Trump's.
The puzzling thing, look, our policies so far have failed. So a tougher policy is not necessarily a bad idea. Putting more pressure on China is not necessarily a bad idea. But then there was the report late last week that President Trump was seriously considering scrapping our trade agreement with South Korea. At the very moment when we should really be joined at the hip with South Korea, he's talking about entering into, taking actions that might result in a trade war. That was puzzling.
So we could talk about the Trump administration ad nauseum, but that will apparently soon be the job of a certain former Milwaukee sheriff. The report is David Clark, having abruptly resigned last week, will be taking a job with a pro-Trump political action committee. As we talk, we aren't sure which one it is. But what do you make of the way the end of the Clark era came about?
It was unexpected in the respect that it was so fast. I think that David Clark checked out of that job a long time ago. He was looking for an exit in the worst possible way, and apparently has taken it. When he resigned with no notice whatsoever, by the way, I don't advise anybody else doing that with their employer, with no notice really whatsoever, there was some suggestion that maybe he was going to get a job in the White House or, you know, some very sensitive job that required his immediate presence. Well, apparently that's not the case. And I'm not surprised. Given the professional, the legal baggage that he is bringing, I think that that probably scuttled his chances to get a Homeland Security job. I don't think this administration under Chief of Staff John Kelly was going to bring David Clark into the White House at the very time when they seem to be cleaning house at the White House. So apparently David Clark is going to be doing what he's been doing and now getting paid for it, which is to be going on television and saying nice things about Donald Trump.
Well, and I wonder, given the way that the Homeland Security announcement, then de-announcement played out, whether this was a case of somebody taking the first solid job offer that came his way.
Yeah, you know, I was thinking about that having, and people will remember that he goes on talk radio and announces he's accepting the job before he had been given it. And then there was this long period where everybody was saying, no, we don't know. No,
a couple of months.
Yes. No announcement. So he was really twisting in the wind. Clearly, he did not want something like that to happen again. So we pull the trigger before we find out what the job is going to be. But yeah, the story of David Clark has been an extraordinary one. And obviously, based on the reaction, not just a local story. I mean, you know, we've spent years watching David Clark. I certainly spent a lot of time watching David Clark grow and change and morph in his position. But he's now... he now belongs to all Americans.
Short of Joe Arpaio in Phoenix, there are not a lot of local sheriffs that get the national headlines that David Clark does.
You know, it's interesting that you mentioned that because it apparently, in Donald Trump's world, these are his two favorite lawmen, Joe Arpaio and David Clark, which I'd be interested to know privately what law enforcement officials who actually know, you know, who actually, you know, show up and do their jobs and are concerned about the rule of law. I wonder what they actually think about this. But apparently that is the president's idea of a tough lawman.
So David Clark is no longer the Milwaukee County Sheriff. But how do you see the effects of his tenure lingering into the future?
Well, the effect on law enforcement will be absolutely zero. Number one, because the Sheriff's Department heads under Clark had so little impact. But he's also, as I mentioned before, he's been checked out for so long. It's hard to imagine how it will change things, except that I was speaking to somebody who was around some of the deputies in the wake of the resignation, and they were described as being much more relaxed than they were before. I do think that as many strengths as David Clark had in terms of highlighting certain issues, his indifference to his day job really was becoming a significant problem, or had become a significant problem, with the lawsuits, the deaths in the jail, some of the other practices. And I think this will be a good opportunity for everybody to turn their page and perhaps now have a sheriff's department that might actually work well and play well with others when it comes to others in the community and in law enforcement.
Well, along those lines, what would you expect in terms of a replacement from Governor Walker?
Well, this is a tricky one because, remember, David Clark was appointed by Republican Governor Scott McCallum, but he never ran as a Republican, in part because in Milwaukee County, you can't win as a Republican. So nobody was fooled by the fact that David Clark was really a Democrat, but he ran as a Democrat. So that's going to be interesting. When Scott Walker appoints someone, will they run as a Democrat or as a Republican? If they run as a Republican, they're going to be here for basically a year and a half or so, because it's hard to imagine a Republican winning. But there are a lot of strong candidates. One of the reasons why I'm not surprised that David Clark was looking for an exit was I don't think there was any way that he was going to win another primary. He was not going to survive in this election.
Finally, the effort to recall Milwaukee Mayor Tom Barrett came up short this week when the man behind the petition drive announced he had apparently misread public sentiment. And he apologized to the mayor for, quote, any annoyance his drive may have caused. This was not necessarily an effort that got a lot of traction.
What a complete waste of time. When I first heard about this, I think it was out of town, and I was thinking, what was the point of that? I mean, look, recalls became a big deal here. You might recall, I mean, the first big recall was the effort to recall Tom Amott, which resulted in his resignation. And then, of course, all the recalls involved in the Walker era. But you have to have people who are aroused. People just don't want to have a do-over when it comes to an election. And, you know, whether you like him or not, Tom Barrett just has not and will never inspire that kind of passion.
Charlie Sykes, you inspire a lot of passion in all of us. Thanks.
Thank you.
News analyst Charlie Sykes is a Lake Effect contributor and a regular guest on MSNBC. He's a former talk show host and Milwaukee journalist.
As the school year begins, parents begin to worry about protecting their kids from sports-related concussions. We'll learn more when Lake Effect returns on 89.7 WUWM. More of Lake Effect Now. I'm Mitch Tyke.
And I'm Bonnie North. Back to school often means back to sports for many kids. Football, cross country, swimming, tennis, and volleyball, among others, all make their return in the fall season. And with the return of practices and games, returns the risk of injury. According to the latest numbers from the Centers for Disease Control, more than 300,000 kids 19 and younger are treated for sports-related concussions every year.
Luckily, Milwaukee is home to one of the leading research teams on concussions in youth sports. Dr. Kevin Walter is part of that team. He directs the Pediatric and Adolescent Sports Medicine Program at Children's Hospital of Wisconsin. Dr. Walter spoke with Lake Effect's Rachel Morello about common misconceptions around concussions and what parents can do to calm their nerves as kids take the field this fall.
So I think looking back to when I came out of training in 2004, the number of concussions definitely increased since then. Over the last few years, it's increasing at a slower rate. And I think a lot of that increase is just greater awareness. You know, it seems like you can't open a newspaper or turn on the TV without hearing so-and-so got a concussion, which is great, but it also makes people scared. You know, oh my gosh, is concussion going to turn me into these NFL players? And it won't. But I also think that some of the increase is kids are training differently. You know, middle school kids are doing things that used to be done at high school and collegiate level. So they're training better, they're bigger, stronger, faster, and there's wonderfully a lot more opportunity for kids to participate in youth sports. But when you participate in sports, there's risk of sport with injury, and so more exposure with sport equals more injuries as well.
Do you find, I don't want to throw shade at parents, but is there risk for overdiagnosis by a parent or a non-clinical person just because they're hearing about this becoming a thing or they're seeing it on the news, they're hearing about these NFL players, because I feel like that's where we hear the most about it. Mm-hmm. Do people jump to conclusions that their kid might have a concussion a lot more quickly now?
Yeah, I think so. Again, going back to 2004 when I came out of training, I used to have to scare people, you know, say, this is a concussion. You've got to take it seriously. If you don't, you can have months of symptoms. And I have now moved to the point where I don't even bring that stuff up because people come in scared enough. And I have to kind of talk them down the ledge of, no, your child's first concussion will not cause long-term problems. It will not drop their IQ or make them dumber. It will not lead to permanent mood or behavioral changes. I expect full recovery if you do the right thing. But a lot of times somebody hits their head and now there's a headache or grades have dropped and people just try and put two and two together. Could this be concussion related? And so they jump, maybe it is, and they bring them in. And we find, you know, a handful of patients every month in our clinic that just don't appear to be concussion but are symptoms from another problem, like a headache disorder. You've got new onset migraines, but you first noticed them after soccer practice. And you thought, well, maybe I hit my head, maybe I have a concussion.
So I've never had a concussion, knock on wood, but I don't know if I could even recognize the signs for one if I thought that might be what was wrong with me. What would be the signs? What would someone come in thinking they'd have a concussion? Why?
Yeah. So signs and symptoms. The most common one that a lot of people know about is headache. You can get dizziness. You can get nausea. You can see spots and have quick vision changes. Some people experience higher degrees of symptoms than others. And then when you interact with people, they'll complain about memory loss. They'll repeat answers. They'll get confused. They'll be slower. They'll be foggier. And those are kind of the bigger symptoms of the physical side of things, headaches, nausea, et cetera. the cognitive or thinking side of things, just the slowness and fogginess. And then you can get some sleep problems. Usually those manifest a little bit later. And then you can get some mood. The way I always say, if you had a headache all day, you'd be grouchy too. But with concussion, kids just get a little more mood swingy and more emotional. But right out of the gate is usually a pretty common story of there was a head impact. And immediately following this head impact, I got these physical slash cognitive symptoms.
So we were talking about this before we turned the mics on, but who is coming into you with concussions most often? I know we said like just sort of living puts you at risk for this, but if we're talking about kids who are student athletes, what sports are they playing? What's happening to them? Give me an idea of who's coming to see you.
So the cool thing with concussion is there's been a lot more research in epidemiology, who gets them and how many. I think the latest paper that came out said across the U.S. in pediatric and adolescent sport and recreation related concussion, 1.1 to 1.9 million a year. So it's an astounding number.
Wow.
When you look at the sports, football is still the highest. Big collision sport, lots of players on the field. Soccer, wrestling, ice hockey, lacrosse, rugby, field hockey is in there too. I know that's a much more regional sport. Those make up that next tier. You could argue throwing basketball in there as well. Skiing, snowboarding, skateboarding, bike riding, recreation or sporty activities, but not like high school sanctioned sports. Mm-hmm. There's a fair number in those too. And then, you know, we see it even in sports that people never would imagine. Concussion, track, swimming, you know, any sport, you can get it if you have enough bad luck.
That's true. You were talking about the number that people get. And I had a friend who had had multiple concussions and was told, you know, you get one more, you're done. Is there like a magic number that you really shouldn't let yourself get to before you take yourself out of an activity like a sport?
All right. So is there a magic number? No, but I will tell you the thing that I most commonly hear is three. Oh my gosh, if you have three and you're done. And I think that trickles back to like the mid-90s. Three was a number where if you had three in a season, you would be done for that season. And that number three just stuck around. But I don't think there's hard evidence for why three. Why not two? Why not four? Nobody knows. You know, clearly one is too many because nobody wants one. But what I start to think about when I treat kids with multiple concussions is what's their risk of repeat injury? Because with every concussion, that increases. Making sure that they're fully recovered. So am I worried that if they got another concussion, do they have a greater likelihood potentially of not fully recovering or having substantial academic harm or substantial prolonged recovery, months and months and months? And those are the things that I try and bring up with parents. And I think that's the tricky part with treating concussion is there's no set guideline of this is too many, this is too long, this is when you need to retire. It's a whole lot of gray.
Has a parent ever come to you and said, should I even let my kid go out for the team? It's been midseason. He's had this. Should I tell him he has to stop before the season's over? I mean, is that a should that be a medical call or should it be a parental safety call? I don't even know how to phrase that.
Really, I think that's a both. I mean, I think as a physician, a family should be able to come in and ask me anything. And, you know, my knowledge about concussion in general is going to be more than theirs. And so when families come in and they hear a lot of bad things about football and read the news about players that have committed suicide and players that are retiring because they're worried about brain damage, it's going to strike a nerve. And my kid wants to play football. Geez, is that really the best thing for them? So I get asked that all the time, whether it's football, soccer, basketball, should I allow my child to play? Or after an injury in the middle of the season, should I let my child go back into the sport? And my approach to sport is I would rather have kids healthy and active than sitting around eating chips playing video games. I am a firm believer in youth learning life's lessons through sports. I think it's teamwork, how to win, how to lose, how to follow the rules, how to work with authority, how to become a leader of others, et cetera, stuff like that. So I strongly encourage sport participation. And I think the key thing that families need to be comfortable with is the fact that there's risk. And, you know, with football, we talk concussion. There's risk for broken bones, torn ACLs, in all of these sports. But that sport, I think they need to be comfortable with the team, meaning is the coach someone that they trust? You know, coach becomes a second parent, let's face it. And not to throw coaches under the bus, but there are definitely coaches that if you try and report an injury, they will say hide it. Even today, I hear that all the time, kind of ostracize them from the team, which is clearly not helpful or a good thing. So if as a parent you don't feel that the coach is acting appropriately, or I don't know if in your child's best interest is the right way to say it, then you got to think twice about that. And then I think the other thing that makes sense for parents to do is to look into the what ifs. What if my child gets a concussion? What happens? Who evaluates them? What happens on the sideline? What is the process for removing them from play, getting through treatment, and then getting them back to play? Because all teams, whether it is 7 or 8 years old or 18 years old, should have that process in place. And so that's what I tell families is if you're comfortable with the coach, if they've got that process in place, you've done your due diligence as a parent, you've vetted that team, that organization, and if your kid wants to play, let them play.
If we just ran through some of your sort of advice for families, if you're talking to coaches and athletes themselves, you were mentioning earlier that training is a lot different nowadays. Is there a prevention tip that applies across sports, you know, for taking yourself out of play if you feel the risk is too high, or any tips you have for the people in the sport?
I think there's not necessarily prevention, but ways to reduce risk. Number one, if you have protective equipment, wear it properly. You know, we know football helmets don't prevent concussion, but if you wear them properly, they can reduce other injuries and maybe they help with concussion a little. Number two, don't lead with your head in contact sports. So if you can keep the head out of the game, then you can reduce that risk. And then I think the other one that you look at is play within the rules. I took care of a school in the past, a high school, and people will say, oh, you know, they're letting them play, they're letting them get rough, and just let them play the game and don't over-officiate. And I mean, it was bad, and I leaned over to a ref and said, hey, somebody's going to get hurt. You got to start calling this game a little tighter, please. And I was told if I talked to him again that they would penalize the team and throw me out. You know, some refs will be more responsive than that. But if you can officiate properly and teach proper technique, that gives you your best shot at reducing risk.
So better safe than sorry would be an appropriate mm-hmm. way to go with concussions.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
When in doubt, hold them out.
Dr. Kevin Walter is a clinical researcher at Children's Hospital of Wisconsin. He spoke with education reporter Rachel Morello.
Coming up next, our On That Note series explores how musicians use their memory in practice and performance. This is Lake Effect from Milwaukee Public Radio.
We're back with more of Lake Effect on 89.7 WUWM. I'm Bonnie North.
And I'm Mitch Teich. Each month, cellist Robert Cohen joins us to talk about the life of a professional classical musician. Our On That Note series has tackled everything from traveling with an extremely rare and valuable instrument too large for the overhead bin to what it's like to perform with musicians who were once your students.
This month, memory steps into the spotlight. Memorizing music is a vital part of performing, and any soloist worth his or her salt will not take the stage without knowing their solo part, well, backwards. But how do you get 30 or 40 or even more minutes of music into your brain and body? Cohen says the skills required are often overlooked.
We all naturally remember so many things, and we remember music. We can sing a song, and you know, sometimes we know all the words, and like you said last month, you know, there are, you know, memories from things you heard in the 60s, the late 60s, that you remember perfectly, even if you haven't thought about them. I think we all do remember incredible amount, and musicians, classical musicians, I mean, most of us feel much better when we play a piece of music on the platform from memory. We feel kind of more free and less having to, you know, there's this almost like a mini barrier between us and the audience when the music is there on a stand, and we're looking at it sometimes. But when we play from memory, there's this sense that everything comes as we're freer to interpret spontaneously in a way, and we just feel better. However, there are people who suffer terribly because the process of memorizing is difficult, and when they get on the platform, that's one of their biggest anxieties, is that they're actually going to forget what they have to play. And I think we all have those moments. All musicians have those moments that, you know, particularly in complicated pieces of music, are you just going to remember, you know, a small detail? And if you don't remember that small detail, will it totally derail you and you'll end up, you know, at standstill or, you know, fumbling around trying to remember where you are? And that's a kind of nightmare scenario. So what I've done actually is to kind of analyze and formulate a kind of system for memorizing music, which I find is really, really effective. And I think it really works for other things too. You know, memorizing probably a speech or memorizing maybe a route. You know, you sometimes see these kind of so-called kind of magicians on the television, and they have this extraordinary ability to memorize things. And they have a system. And I have a system for music, which breaks things down into about five different sections. The first, really, the first simple thing that one has to be aware of is just that you do really know how the sound of the music, like the melody, you know, so you can sing the whole thing, which, you know, is quite tough when you've got to play a piece that's 25, 35, 45 minutes long. But if you don't remember how the sound of it, how it goes, as though you were singing in your head without hesitation from beginning to end, then you're never going to be able to play it from memory. So the first task really is to be able to sing it in your head or to hear it in some way in your head from beginning to end. If you have a problem at any point and just don't know what to do next, then we look at the music and really figure out where it is that you have to go. And you have to practice those kind of corners, as it were, in your head or on your instrument until you clearly remember what it sounds like.
Now, this idea of being able to sing it in your head or hear it in your head, I imagine that's easier if it's a piece that's already in the repertoire. Say you're learning something by Haydn or you're learning something by Berlioz or whatever. You can listen to somebody else do it, literally listen to somebody else do it and get that in your head that way. But if it's a new piece of music that has not ever been performed before, does the technique change at all?
Not really, because what I mean is not so much that you would listen to anybody else, but really that you would play the music or sing it to yourself, reading the score.
Okay.
So that you're listening to how you want to hear it in your head. And that would be the same with a new piece of music. I mean, you're learning a new piece of music, you figure out how to play the first 12 notes technically, and then you listen to it and you hear it in your head how you would like it to sound. So it's that kind of singing it in your head, that first 12 notes and then the next 12 notes and so on and so on and so on, until you actually can just literally close your eyes and either play the music or sing the music in your head right from beginning to end without there being a problem. And you cannot play music without that. That's the kind of fundamental first thing that you have to be able to do when you memorize.
So when you do that, when you close your eyes and do that, are you actually seeing the notes on the page, or are you not using that kind of visualization?
You're jumping ahead of me here.
Oh, okay. Sorry about that.
No, not at all, because that's a very important thing. Yeah, I mean, the kind of what I call photographic memory, the kind of thing that enables you to imagine the music in front of you, even with your eyes closed. For some people, that's incredibly important. There are some people who literally can remember exactly what the music looks like. They can read the music in their head with their eyes closed from their photographic memory. But that's quite unusual. Most people don't remember that so well. Although, when you've been studying the music for a while, you do tend to have a quite good memory. As you're singing the music or playing the music through, you'll know roughly where you are, whether you're halfway down the first page, whether you're onto the second page, whether you turn the page to the third. You know, you start to remember where you are. You do have a visual memory of it. And that is something that is one of the parts of my system that I think that we have to be aware of, so that you actually think about it rather than it just being there. And then we have another part of the memorizing, which is how it physically feels to play. And we mentioned this about kind of the muscle memory thing that people talk about, and musicians very often talk about that. And what I do is I try this system of singing the music in your head and playing sort of like air cello. So, you know, you're moving your body and your fingers to go with the music that's in your head and making very obvious physical movements, but not actually playing the instrument. And that way you sort of, you know, you don't have any of the problems that you might have when you were playing, the intonation problems or the technical things, because it all sounds perfect in your
yes, head. Because it's in your head.
Yes. Yes. So you're listening to this perfect performance and you're making sure that you know where every finger goes, every bowing is, which string you're playing on. And what you do is, if you're not quite sure, you then again study the score to make sure why, until you're fluent with that side. And that then there's another part of that kind of physical memory that's very important, which is imagining how your body moves, even if you don't move it. So instead of playing air cello, you just literally imagine yourself playing air cello. Or imagine yourself playing the cello. So it's like without the physical movements to remind you.
There are athletes that do that, that will go through a race literally just with their eyes closed. They're not actually running or riding or doing whatever, but they will literally go through the entire thing. So it's that kind of psychological visualization.
And you know what? Then now scientists are saying that your muscles learn to do things just by you thinking about it. So people who've had some sort of brain damage or some accident, and they're just finding it difficult to, say, move their arm at all, they've discovered that if they practice thinking about moving their arm, it speeds up the process so much more. And then we have another section, another discipline, which I like to talk about, which is the sense of, you know, what are you doing with the music? So the interpretive side of it, because if you don't really, really know exactly what you feel about the music and how you would like it to go and what you think about the composer's wishes in the minutest detail sometimes, I mean, just literally how you would breathe the end of a phrase or how you would like the emotions of the music to be, then that indecision in your preparation leads to kind of your lack of focus and your lack of understanding of why you wanted to play. And that's dangerous for memorizing, because the flow of the music and the intention of the music is probably the most powerful part of memorizing. If you go a bit blank as to why you're playing, you're liable to break down anyway, because, you know, there's just not enough of the driving force behind everything. So that's very, very important that you have that understanding, your interpretation, your decisions about every single detail. And actually that goes along with another part that you have to understand, which is the kind of analysis of the way the music has been put together and created. So the structure of the music and the way it's pieced together, literally section A, section B, section C, how they fit together, which parts come from, you know, the development of one section of another, the ideas of the composer that like seeds growing through the music. And when you understand the architecture and the structure of the music really, really well, that's another kind of thing that ties in maybe with that visualization, that thing about knowing where you are on the page, how far through the journey you've gone. So all of those details are immensely important. And what you can do to practice those things is just literally to, you know, test yourself, you know, to think about the music and think about what it is, where you are and which section you're. I mean, sometimes with students, for instance, I say, take the score and put colors in, different paint colors into your music, so you know that, you know, one section is blue, then it goes to red, and so on, so that you can kind of draw pictures and ways of reminding yourself how it goes.
It's funny you mentioned color. I once spoke to a guitarist here who is synesthetic, and he says that the way he actually sees the music in color as he's performing it, and he knows where he is in a song by what colors he's seeing. So if he goes somewhere and makes a mistake, the color goes the wrong way, he knows he's in the wrong place. And I thought, wow, that is just amazing.
Well, that's amazing, isn't it?
Yeah, and so it's, in a way, you're asking your students, if you're doing color, is to have some other way of dropping into the music.
Yes. And I think the reason why I've separated these components and I focus so clearly on each one is because when you do get on the platform, you don't want to think about one thing or two things. You want to be free to jump in and out or pull one idea out for a moment if necessary. You might just want suddenly to see the music in your head visually, or you might want to think about where you are in the journey, or you might want to think what the feeling of the color is, or the interpretation, or your emotions. But if you have all of that in your subconscious and ready to be used at any one time, you do feel so much more confident and able to manage situation, because you've got this multifaceted memory. And since memory for every person is so different, like your guitarist, I mean, that must be so unusual to be remembering by colors. I mean, he's found the solution for him. And we all need to, you know, for memorizing. And I think what's also fascinating is that, you know, we can't learn without memorizing. I mean, musicians sometimes think that memorizing music is the kind of last step you do before you, you know, go onto the platform. But in fact, if you really think about it, when you learn the first line of a song, if you don't actually memorize it, then when you come back to it the next day, you start from the beginning again.
Or you never get to the second line because you've forgotten the first one.
Yes. Every step of the way is actually memorizing.
Including where the note sounds on the instrument.
Yes.
You know, you have to remember where the C is and how to get G and how, you know. And so, yeah, you're right. It all falls back on that. Well, Robert, hopefully here's to many more years of memorizing and hearing and wonderful music. And we're looking forward to having you back here in Milwaukee in October.
Thank you.
And look forward to having you in the studio at that time as well.
I hope I remember where it is.
There is that. It may change. Anyway, until we speak and see each other again, have a wonderful fall.
Thank you very much, Bonnie, and you too.
Cellist Robert Cohen joins us each month for a segment we call On That Note. You can find the entire series at WUWM.com.
We'll take one last break and then explore the second season of the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel's Unsolved podcast. That comes your way when Lake Effect returns on Milwaukee Public Radio.
More of Lake Effect now on Milwaukee Public Radio. I'm Mitch Tyke.
And I'm Bonnie North. And this is how the second season of the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel's Unsolved podcast begins.
Back in 1981, Michelle Manders was 2.5 years old, and she lived with her family in a duplex in Watertown. And in October of that
The second year, installment in the 8-part print and audio series is published today. Gina Barton is a criminal justice investigative reporter for the Journal Sentinel, and she joins us in the studio to tell us a little more about the latest series. Nice to see you again.
Thanks for having me.
Well, let's start with a thumbnail sketch of the crime that is at the heart of the second Unsolved series, both the podcast and the articles that go with it.
The current season of Unsolved is about the disappearance and death of a little girl named Michelle Manders, who was 2.5 years old when she disappeared from her home in Watertown back in 1981.
Let me ask how the success of the first season of Unsolved shaped how you approach this one.
In the first season of Unsolved, we looked at the case of John Zara, who was 14 when he disappeared from Franklin High School. And after that series ran and after that podcast came out, I got a whole bunch of emails, phone calls, feedback from people saying, hey, will you look into my relative's case, my loved one's case? And so I heard from Michelle's brother, Chris, who is now in his 40s, saying, we've always had questions about my sister's death. Would you look into her case? And so I was able to get some documentation from the police about his sister's case, and I found lots of people to interview, so we went ahead with it.
I was going to ask about that. I would imagine that one of the things that you have to have in order to be able to pursue a case like this for a season of Unsolved is enough people who were around at the time of the crime and are still around and have the crime still sort of firmly in their memory.
Definitely. I think you need two things. You need some sort of documentation, police reports, media archives. You need some kind of recorded or written reports. And then you also need people to interview so that you can make sure that those two things are similar. And in the first season of Unsolved, I had 6,000 pages of police reports and a couple of really enthusiastic police officers, but only one family member. This season, most of the records have been destroyed, which may be one reason why it's still unsolved. But I was able to get 200 pages of police reports and a couple of law enforcement people. But I spent lots of time with Michelle's mother and sister and brother. So this season, we're hearing more from the family about the effects of her loss on them.
Why were so many of the documents in this case destroyed?
That's an excellent question that I haven't gotten a clear answer to yet. The most that I can tell is that because they ruled Michelle's death an accident, which again, I'm not sure if that's what it actually was, but in any case, had it been ruled a homicide, they would have to keep all the documentation and evidence until it's solved. But in ruling it an accident, that requirement goes away. So the last I was able to figure out is that all of the documents were destroyed several years ago.
So without going into too much detail, because obviously this is why people would read the series and listen to the podcasts, why is it such a complex case?
Michelle disappeared from her bedroom in Watertown in the middle of the night. She was 2.5 years old. It was a rainy night. It was obviously dark. And 22 days later, her body was found on the bank of the Rock River. It was ruled a drowning, but she had some other injuries that could have been caused by beating, strangling. What the medical examiner did is kind of put the context together and decided, yes, she died of a drowning. And then from there, the authorities made the leap that, okay, it was an accident. But nobody ever figured out how did she get from her house to the river.
What are the kinds of technologies that did not exist at the time of Michelle's death that, had this investigation taken place today, might have made the difference?
That's one of the things that's been so hard about looking into this case, is that if that had happened today, she probably wouldn't have died. They didn't have Amber Alerts back then. Those didn't come on the scene until 96. They didn't have the electronic billboards that you see now, the cell phone alerts that you have with missing kids. So that's part one, where maybe she would have been found before she died, whether she had wandered out of the house or been kidnapped or whatever. And then the other thing is, of course, no DNA back then. And again, if there had been DNA, would they have thought to look for it on some of the evidence? If they thought it was an accident and that, you know, predetermined the investigation, I don't know. But we can't go back now and test any of those items.
How long have you been working on this series?
I've been working on this for probably about a year. After the first season of Unsolved, I took a little bit of time off with murder cases. Because as you can imagine, it gets a little bit personally difficult to deal with that all the time.
Well, right. I was going to ask, you know, this must have been equally intense for you.
Yes. I have two kids. And just last week, I had asked my sister if she would listen to this season and tell me what she thought. And really quickly, she texted me and said, oh, this is about a dead baby. I can't listen to that because my nephew's 2.5, which is the same age Michelle was.
How do you weigh the competing issues of, you know, wanting really to do justice to this family that went through this, and at the same time making something that's compelling listening and, you know, and at some level is entertaining?
That's something that I always struggle with in almost any story I do or any project or investigation I do, because if it's not interesting, people aren't going to read it, aren't going to listen to it, and it's not going to have any impact. But you can't cross that line of being so interesting that it's exploitive. So I try really hard to think a lot about, if I were this mother, what would I think of this? You know, if this were my family member that this had happened to, how would I feel about this presentation? And I may not always be perfect at that, but I try really hard to think about that. And when I'm interviewing the people, the family members, I try to explain to them exactly what I'm going to do and why I'm going to do it, so that they aren't surprised if it comes off as a little bit more interesting than, you know, they might want it to.
This is not something that you would normally do when you're out there just interviewing somebody for I don't want to call anything you do a run-of-the-mill story, but for an 800-word story that's going to run in the daily paper.
Right. I think the big difference is the more time you spend on something, the more you are asking a family to invest their time, their trust in you, the more that you owe them in terms of those expectations and those feedbacks. It's a lot different, you know, spending hours. I went to Arizona, where Michelle's mom lives now, and spent two entire days with her recording and interviewing and looking at scrapbooks about Michelle and things like that. That's a lot different than a daily story when you would call somebody and have a 5-minute phone call with them.
I imagine you would expect after this series you're going to get even more calls and emails from people hoping that season 3 is about their unsolved case.
I'm guessing it will. In fact, I already have two other cases that I'm kind of tossing around that might be interesting. And the other thing that's tough about picking the next one is that I have listeners all over America and even in Australia, Europe. And so when I hear from those people, it's really kind of hard to explain to them, well, I'm actually in Wisconsin. My employer's in Wisconsin, so we need to do a Wisconsin case. Maybe that'll change at some point.
Does it surprise you that there's so many cases that are out there that actually have played out in southeastern Wisconsin that could be material for another series?
It doesn't really surprise me, because the timing isn't limiting me. It's not like I have to have a case that happened 2 years ago or 5 years ago or within the past 10 years even. I think if you tried to go back much before about 1970, it would get really tough, because people would have passed away or their memories wouldn't be as good. But so far, I'm thinking that if you go back all the way to 1970, that's a lot of time to work with and a lot of unsolved cases.
Gina Barton, job well done. Thanks.
Thanks, Mitch.
Gina Barton is a criminal justice investigative reporter for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. She's the host of the latest season of the newspaper's Unsolved podcast. The latest episode is out today, and you will find a link at WUWM.com. And that is Wednesday's edition of the show. I'm Bonnie North.
And I'm Mitch Tyke. Thanks so much for tuning in today. And please be with us tomorrow at 10 for another edition of Lake Effect from listener-supported 89.7 WUWM Milwaukee Public Radio, NPR in Milwaukee.
It is 11 o'clock, so stay tuned. Fresh air comes your way next.